Welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We have a great show for you today. We have a great interview to play today on the show, which I did last week with the assistant editor-in-chief of Beside Magazine, Mark Mann. And Beside Magazine is an amazing magazine. Comes out twice a year, but has a lot of online features as well. But it attempts to bridge the gap between humans and nature. So it explores really in depth where those things meet up, nature and humans. And the 9th edition is all about how do we embody our Nordicity and living in harmony with the seasons, encouraging the locally made and the locally grown, embracing a more minimalist lifestyle, learning to read the nature that surrounds us in the city as well as the forest. Could Nordicity help us embrace this way of life? In the face of current crises, could it infuse our daily lives with precious tools, slowness, presence, and a sense of community? So there's all kinds of great articles in here, and Mark's going to tell me more about it in the interview that we're going to listen to now. So check it out. Here it is. My interview with Mark Mann from Beside Magazine. This is Ryan Young for CKUT 90.3 FM and Equilibrium. We are here with Mark Mann, who is the associate editor and chief of Beside Magazine, which is a very interesting magazine when it comes to the environment because it attempts to bridge the gap between humans and nature. And at this magazine, they bring together journalists, philosophers, artists, chefs, farmers, scientists, and adventurers to empower people with the tools to live a more meaningful life and build a more sustainable future. And it's published by Beside Media. And so, Mark, tell me how you got involved with the magazine, first of all.
Well, thanks, Ryan. I've been an independent journalist for, I guess, nigh on a decade, and we were freelancing before then, and moved to Montreal because I met my wife, and had been living in Toronto and working in Toronto, and came, you know, on a gamble really, and continued to work in Toronto, but was just very fortunate to get connected to Beside. Never anticipated to find such a beautiful publication that was committed to being bilingual, and where I could work as an Anglophone, you know, on a team of Francophones, and create this, you know, really vision-oriented publication with a focus on nature and culture. So yeah, it's been awesome. Been about 2 or 3 years since I've been involved. Yeah.
Nice. And what do you think is unique about the publication?
I'm not sure that there's much else like it. I mean, I think it comes through at a key moment of transition, to put it a bit grandly, but I think it's really true that a lot of the culture of, say, outdoor magazines, outdoor adventure magazines, as well as environmentally focused magazines, conservation focused magazines, a lot of that stuff is shifting, and some of that's generational, you know, it's just and the world's changing. I think Beside is kind of landing at a moment, or appearing in the world at a moment when there's a deeper understanding of kind of the importance of, if we're going to protect nature, if we're going to value nature, we have to be in nature and experiencing nature. So there's that emphasis, that kind of broader emphasis on, you know, hunting and fishing, as well as farming, as well as urban parks, as well, you know, just the kind of broad spectrum engagement, you know, that's, it's not leave no trace, you know, it's more focused on, the transformation of connecting with the environment. So it's got a younger focus probably, and real strong emphasis on beautiful images, and which is common, but it's not wildlife photography. It's more rooted in, I think, you know, artistic photography, contemporary photography with a natural focus. Mm. Yeah.
And how has it been for the magazine trying to get its name out there, and what do magazines do to try and get their name out there, whether it's in Montreal or across Canada?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, I mean, to answer that question, I'll just sort of share a bit of the origin story. It's interesting. The magazine has two co-founders, Jean-Daniel Petit and Eliane Cadieu, and they were together part of the founding of a previous company called Abitibi and Company, which is a canoe kayak company. And Abitibi and Company was founded in the Abitibi region of Quebec, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago or something, taking over from a fiberglass canoe company that had been around for a long time. And they kind of renovated it and relaunched it, but in this this really values-oriented way, where they were telling their customers not to buy new but to fix their old canoes, and you know what I mean, and also on that belief of to protect waterways, we need more people to be on the waterways, so emphasizing that accessibility and and then all the other things that we care about, like sustaining local traditional craftsmen by sourcing from them and stuff like that, you know what I mean. And because those guys, they actually had come from a media background, sort of advertising and that kind of thing. So they knew storytelling, they understood. Yeah, just they started making these beautiful videos and stuff, of people out on the water in canoes and kayaks doing these crazy long trips and stuff like that. And so I think they conceived Beside in this way. They had found a lot of success for that company, and then conceived Beside as a way to kind of, amplify those values that they were trying to embody, just in making beautiful, high quality, locally made, small vessels. And I think when Beside launched, people connected to it right away, sort of in its own right. They hired Catherine Metayer, who was a kind of a real inspirational, visionary kind of curator, editor. She has a team called Maison Blanc, and they, art curation and stuff like that. So she just brought a vision that I think just really connected. It's been interesting because as a journalist, I've been involved with publications that were really floundering and flagging in the, the internet era. It's extremely hard to adapt and thrive. So I've, just been seeing it over and over again, been involved with publications that just kind of disappear overnight and stuff, And so it's been really interesting to get on this trip with Beside, because people are really resonating and subscribing. And some of that, I think, has to do with it being the emphasis that we put on the print object, which people really value, to be able to hold on to it and have this beautiful publication. But I don't know. I think it's just really I think people are responding. I can't, as I'm an editor, so I'm just fully focused on the stories, and just trying to tell the best possible stories and find the right people. But I know it's been very popular in Quebec, so that's kind of been tons of support here in the region. And then, we distribute across North America and Europe, so we're really kind of getting around. People are finding us in Portland and, San Fran and New York, so it's going well. Yeah.
And you were telling me before we started the interview that these two gentlemen that started it, they're francophones, obviously. And but the magazine is in two languages.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everything is published in both languages, so it all comes in. We get to draw from the full panoply of francophone and anglophone writers and storytellers and photographers, and then we just put in the work. And it's a big operation. We have translators working for us, and the team, our editorial team, is bilingual, but Caroline Baquette, who's the French language senior editor, does the French stories. I do the English stories, and then we just mix it all up.
So the name of the magazine in French is different?
No, actually, it's Beside. Yeah, it's not à côté or okay. It's Beside. Yeah,
that's cool. Tell me about the latest issue. What's the theme of the latest issue, and what would people find in there?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's nice that we're speaking this morning, because I actually just got my copy this morning, so I've been I spent the whole morning just going back through and reading it. So this is issue 9 for us. We're very theme oriented, so we always give a strong overarching theme to every issue, and this issue is themed on the idea of Nordicity or Nordicité. I think your Quebecois listeners might recognize that term. I think it resonates a bit more with Francophones initially, because I think the concept of Nordicité, from my understanding, I'm an East Coaster, so I'm from PEI, but from what they tell me, what the team tells me,
like the hockey team, the Quebec Nordiques, which don't exist anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's like the concept actually comes from this guy Louis Hermelin, who created this polar value index, which was actually used by the Canadian government and the Quebec government to give a kind of numerical value to the degree of northernness of any place between basically the 49th parallel and the Arctic, which has a Nordic value of 100 or something, and it goes down, right? So it's like, it's kind of interesting because it takes in these a lot of different elements, not just, you know, weather or climate, also, you know, proximity to services and stuff like that. And it's interesting because it's this kind of technical measure that is being used in some quarters to also as a way of kind of describing climate change as well. But in Quebec, the concept is, I think, understood more broadly to the idea of like living in sync with the seasons and basically being kind of attuned to the north as a, like an outdoor culture and not just a place where you hibernate, you know what I mean? And in the winter, you know, and reemerge in the spring. And then to connecting that through to English-speaking Canada and to the north, as well as, you know, Scandinavian countries and stuff, I think the idea of the north is, you know, that we the north kind of thing. It's gotten quite popular to think about being north. And at the same time, I think we wanted to sort of trouble that idea too. So we wanted to bring in a lot of perspectives that we're gonna see, that, you know, like Caribbean perspectives in Montreal or you know, decolonizing perspectives of you know, indigenous communities in the north, where, you know, the sort of myth of the north is kind of imposed on them by settlers, and that's something totally different than the reality of northern lifestyle or northern tradition, you know. So I think if you look through this issue, there's really so many different, you know, down to like playing basketball in Quebec City to, you know, indigenous guardians who are, you know, protecting the land in northern BC and the Northwest Territories, to citizen science movements in Nunavut. So it's really cool. Yeah, it's an exciting issue. Mm. Yeah.
So tell me about what you contributed to this issue.
Mm-hmm. So we worked on, we always have a dossier, sort of a theme within the theme, and this will be interesting to your listeners, I think, who are interested in environmentalism. It's a sort of key concept in ecology, I think, over the last few decades. It's this idea of shifting baseline syndrome. So we tied together a number of essays and stories to explore this concept. So just to summarize it quickly, shifting baseline syndrome refers to this idea that we all kind of set a personal baseline for nature unconsciously, that's sort of tied to our first encounters with it, or we create what's sometimes called a point zero in our childhood or whatever, you know. This habit is reflected in scientific practice. It was observed by an ocean and fisheries scientist named Daniel Pauly. Have you heard of him yet?
Yeah, I actually interviewed him once for the show and for a documentary I was working on.
Oh, okay, great. He seems like a great guy. He's hilarious, and I've really enjoyed. I didn't get to speak to him, but I've watched his videos and stuff. So he introduced this idea. It was anecdotal. when he started. He was basically saying that his colleagues and himself were setting kind of markers for rehabilitation. So it's really crucial, if you look at the degradation of a species, the marker for the healthy version of that, people would tie to their first time they start observing it. And they wouldn't really realize that they were doing that. And then when he sort of followed through, he has all these sort of stunning examples of, you know, fishermen who are catching fish that are a tenth of the size or something, you know, and are just as happy as they were before. And the past is sort of erased. And so then scientists have followed through on that and sort of empirically validated those observations by essentially doing this really creative kind of archival research of drawing on these on pretty interesting sources and stuff to mark sort of basically peak populations and stuff being much, much higher. And so we kind of have this false sense of recovery. Talk about, you know, eagles or whales recovering when in fact they're still way, way, way below what might be, you know, a healthy or ecologically healthy for our biosphere or whatever, you know. That's the sort of scientific version of the idea. It goes further than that, I think, in the application to our personal lives. There was a study done on Twitter, actually, just to measure. Maybe you spotted this one. It was to measure how quickly we normalize changes in weather, and it was like it was like a study on like billions of tweets about the weather to see. I don't know exactly how it worked, but it was sort of analyzing people's responses to strange weather, and researchers concluded that people basically have a memory for changes in weather that only goes back between 2 and 8 years, and then it's just sort of we've just adapted, you know.
makes sense.
Yeah. So it's something that I think everyone should really be aware of, you know, because you really have to be, well, it's just good to be aware of it. I mean, it is a feature of our psychology. It does speak to, you know, resilience in a sense and adaptability and some of these qualities that we need to live in a changing world, you know, to normalize things. But we run a great risk, you know.
And you know, that's why I think it's so important and it's so rarely done that, you know, when you speak to people who are truly senior citizens in their 80s and 90s, you always hear, you know, you can sometimes find out what it was like in terms of the abundance of various species of animals.
For sure.
Back then when they were young.
Yeah. I mean, well, I wrote an essay for this issue exploring this idea, and the version of that that I found, I'll just diverge quickly. One anecdote that from my own family, my grandfather drove a bread truck in Fredericton, and he used to drive across the river all winter long on the ice. And
like on an ice bridge, like a road across the ice.
Straight on the surface of the ice, you know. And from what I understand, I haven't verified this, that river barely freezes anymore, you know. I mean, so that's just, you know, two generations. I was looking at birding, actually, just a topic I'd been interested in.
I'm a birder myself.
Oh, are you? Okay, that's interesting. So, if you read my essay, you'll see I'm coming from it from a sort of novice position. Just got interested and started to, but I interviewed, I sort of took that, my kind of ignorance, as like a moment of kind of setting a baseline, you know what I mean? Like, because when you kind of get caught with the bug or whatever, you're just interested to see any bird, right? Like, it's kind of, it's fun to count sparrows or whatever, you know? I mean, I'm, you know, happy to see a starling or something, you know what I mean? Like, initially, you know, and then you catch sight of something else and it's common, but it's, you know, that whole excitement of birding, you know what? So it's an interesting time for birding because the eBird app has been really popular, and it's started to create a kind of ad hoc database for birding that. From what I understand, speaking to birders in the city, and you probably know this very well and have spoken to them, you know, this has become actually a pretty important archive of bird populations. But I went on a tour with Joel Coutu, who I don't know if you've met.
Yeah, him. I know him, and I've interviewed him for this show as well.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, he's a great guy. And Joel made the observation to me that, you know, when a birder goes out now, they might be very excited to see the populations that they can come across in some of those great spots, like out by the airport, the Techno Park or whatever, or Nuns Island. But now, you know, Nuns Island's been built over and a lot of those owls aren't there anymore. And if you'd had any of these old timers who were birding 50 years ago would have seen way, 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 way more than we see today, you know.
I was in Nuns Island as a kid, you know, because I started birding early. And I remember being 11, 12, 13 years old and seeing amazing things on Nuns Island, you know, which you can't really see anymore. I mean, there's still a little pocket left there,
mm-hmm.
but it's not like it was.
Yeah, you know, and it's like even the Techno Park is unprotected. So, you know, they've managed to preserve a little bit of wetland out there, but certainly that's at risk, you know, and it seems to be a pretty vibrant spot for the, in the flyway for birds coming through, you know.
For sure. You know, I do feeder watch. I don't know if you've heard of feeder watch before.
No, not
really. So it's, you know, they're all connected, eBird, feeder watch, but it's people who feed birds in the winter. They actually, you know, it's a citizen science project. You record every 2 weeks for 2 days in a row your observations of the birds visiting your feeder.
Yeah.
You know, and you mark down what the weather was, how many hours you actually watched the feeders, and so on and so forth. And I've been doing it for 10 years at least, I think.
Oh, wow.
And I just moved, but my, you know, so I have a new location now. But my old location, I have like, you know, 8 years of data.
Wow.
You know, and I did see there were trends I saw. And a very specific one is house sparrows, which are a very kind of common in the city species of bird that was originally introduced from Europe.
Yeah.
And is kind of a bird that was not desirable here because it outcompeted the native birds. But funny enough, yes, they're still common in the cities. But, you know, in my area, St. Anne de Bellevue, which is kind of like a mix of urban and suburban, they're not there anymore. Like, I've been doing my feeder watch for the last 2 weeks, not a single house sparrow, you know? And that would never be the case when I was younger, or would never be the case even 10 years ago. 10 years ago, one of the most common birds that would come to your feeder would be house sparrows.
Oh, wow.
So for some reason, their populations are shifting and we don't know why.
That's interesting. Yeah, that was I started feeding this summer, and that was, of course, the bird that almost the only bird that was around. You know, it's interesting. Have they been replaced by another kind of bird, or are they're just not showing up?
Well, I mean, there was the house finch that, when I was young, was rare, and the house finch is originally a bird from the western part of North America, so native to North America, but in the western part of North America, and they were released in the east here and there, and they started to, you know, populate and expand, and now they're very common, and they nest around here. So now, you know, I always have at least three or four house finches in my yard, and you know, so they're not replacing in numbers the same numbers that you would have seen in house sparrows, but they are kind of a bird in the same niche. They're a finch. Mm. They eat seeds primarily, and so it may be explained by that.
Mm.
But it's hard to know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you'll appreciate this article then, because I'm really making an argument for participating in these types of databases. You know, it's I think that, you know, we need to train ourselves to think in a different time scale. You know, we can't really be so easily trapped in our puny, you know, brains, our puny human lifespans, you know. And I think that, you know, it might just be a small contribution, but I do think that these databases are actually kind of a, you know, a vote for the long view, like that kind of, the, I mean, scientists think this way. They think, you know, they don't do one-year studies, you know. It takes them sometimes decades or more to get the picture, you know. And that's also, you know, the other thing that we were looking at is the insect declines, right? And that's a shocking, you know, story that we're, you know, we really have to be grateful to citizen scientists for alerting us to what's happening, because the science, you know, they, it was people that were just dedicated to tracking biomass of insects, you know, just sort of a thankless thing to do in a way, except for that they were able to show, you know, these declines. And that's really significant because it affects bird populations, of course. And also, it's not the same as the loss of the charismatic megafauna. You know, it's these precipitous declines. You still see insects, but you kind of, they call it the windshield phenomenon. You've heard of it?
I have heard of it. And I always wonder, is it, if we were to take a helicopter and get, you know, dropped into the middle of the boreal forest somewhere in the north of Canada and, you know, be far from any road or from any industry, would the populations of insects there be normal? Because I believe that the main reason why the insects have plummeted everywhere else, where there is a lot of agriculture and humans, is because of pesticide use, you know?
Yes.
But that's why I'm curious, is right. this phenomena more of a phenomena in the areas where humans are concentrated? Or is it global? And then if it's global, then there's even more going on to the story.
Right? Yeah, that's interesting. I think that there's only a handful of studies, and they're mostly in Europe, mostly German and then Dutch, I think. And I know there was one. It seemed like the German study was looking at nature reserves. They were collecting from these bioreserves. So it's possible that it is having more of a global impact, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so tell me about, you know, another thing that you contributed to the magazine that you were really interested in, whether it would be this issue or a past issue that...
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of exciting stories. One of the things that I found, one of the kind of ways that we took a twist on this Nordicity idea. We had a writer who'd recently spent time in Qatar in the desert, and that it really offers a kind of inverted view of what we're experiencing in the north. So we had a firsthand account on the one hand, a young Inuit woman, and they were actually also kind of engaged in a form of documentation. This was in the same Shifting Baseline dossier. These Inuit teenagers that had formed a film collective, and they were doing a lot of interviews with their elders, which I think is also just a way of taking stock and not just accepting whatever's happening right now, you know, but really drawing in that perspective of the elders. And I was really happy with what she contributed in terms of just it being a very personal, rooted perspective on the changes that they see, you know, like when they drive their ATVs, you know, permafrost changes, the land gets wobbly, you know what I mean? Like the land goes where they can't drive where they used to drive because they'll get thrown from their ATVs, you know, as an example. I think it's really helpful to get into the body and know that what it feels like. It feels like getting jostled around when you're on the land when you didn't used to, you know, stuff like that. And then we also had this a writer who we were fortunate had been in Doha, where they have all of these sort of like snow playgrounds indoors in their malls, you know. And this is, it's I think the wealthiest country in the world, or one of the wealthiest. And so they're channeling all this oil wealth, which is, of course, you know, contributing to the situation that we're in, and air conditioning the desert, and, you know, playing, going sledding inside with snow that they make themselves, you know. So I find that just so striking as an image. So useful to see the two side by side, I think.
Absolutely. And maybe I'd like to ask you a question about yourself. So being a writer yourself, what are some qualities that you think maybe that you recognize in yourself that are good if you are going to be a writer? Or do you ever think about that? And does that ever, you know, come into play in your mind when thinking about writing as a skill or as a métier?
Yeah, sure. Are you thinking in terms of like environmental journalism or more broadly?
I guess more broadly, but I'd be interested in that specific area as well, because that is what you're doing with this magazine.
Yeah, so. Sure. Well, I guess one thing I've been thinking about a lot I've been primarily a journalist and then just in the last few years more of an editor. And it's been really nice at Beside to be not having to write every story that comes up, but being able to assign the story and get pitches from people and work with other storytellers, because fundamentally I just love story, you know, and helping people develop stories and finding the angles and ways to tell it. And also ways that I wouldn't think of. So I get to touch a lot more stories than I used to, which is really enjoyable. And for me, the metaphor that I have been thinking about the most is actually photography, or the idea of framing. I like photography, not particularly good at it, but I like the way that you can throw up four lines on the world and create a composition in an instant, and how you can do that anywhere, at any time, with anything. And there's always some sort of within the field of vision, there's a possible frame, you know, that would tell a story. I think about that all the time with writing, because I think every writer, every journalist, every storyteller, there's this initial overwhelm, you know, when you see, you know, something dramatic happening, or you see a tension in the world, or you see a topic that is important. You get that kind of full sweep of the whole thing, and that's reality. You know, reality doesn't fit in as a story, you know, because it's everything. And so then that work of finding a way to create a frame that lets people see what's in front of them, because that's essentially what framing does. It's like a you know, a device that helps us see, you know, and without it, it would be a glaze or a wash, you know. So I think that's the gift of storytelling. And I think that, you know, from there, it becomes a labor of sort of almost like zooming in and out, you know, and just getting and or moving your own body, closer or farther away to see the way you look at a painting and you walk backwards and then you walk up and put your nose to it, kind of that type of modulation, I think, is really, you know, that's the gift, you know, I mean, that's the work that people do. And then beyond that, the other thing I think that is so crucial, especially, I think, you know, with environmental storytelling, there's a way that readers often feel like they already know what they're going to get, you know, and there's this sense of taking your medicine, kind of, you know, you know, it's this kind of labor that we do because we care, but it's sort of unpleasant, you know, and I don't think it needs to be like that. And I think that we can kind of save ourselves from sort of going dull, you know, because of needing to pound the table by looking at details, You know, I think it's the detail that will bring us back, you know, to what we're trying to learn or trying to understand. Yeah.
And another question I had was the magazine you work for, Beside Magazine, and the founders of it definitely are based in Quebec and even a B2B, you mentioned that area. But Montreal, you're from the Maritimes, you live in Montreal. The magazine, I guess, is housed here in Montreal. Mm-hmm. What do you think about Montreal that lends itself to publishing a magazine like this? What is it about the scene of the cultural scene or the literary scene or whatever, you know, that kind of helped birth a magazine like this?
Yeah. I have some thoughts about that. I think that,
And how have you found it, just yourself being here, living here, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because actually right before I moved to Montreal, I was in the process of getting to know the woman that would be my wife who lives here. But I was also in the process of getting priced out of Toronto too. And it's funny because I had come to a moment of decision where the choice was to move to Montreal, where I'd done my undergrad, so I knew the city and loved it. And also, you know, made quite a lot of committed effort to learn French as best I can. So, or I was going to move into a school bus in a field, you know, on a farm north of Toronto. You know, that was my sort of second plan. And I was really tottering between the two, and thank God I came here. But it was, you know, the sort of call to be outside was really strong for me, and I really wanted that. Coming to Montreal and getting into this, like I've been really wanting to tell stories about the ocean actually, and I got started at Beside because they were really sympathetic to that type of storytelling, and I had just been working as a journalist doing science journalism and tech journalism, and I just kept being like pitching and wanting to write stories about bluefin tuna and stuff like that, you know, and so, you know, Beside was receptive to that. And the thing that was cool about them, and I think it's part of French culture, because they're Quebec has this outdoor culture that's really strong. And since being here, Quebecois friend of mine roped me into a 5-day ski trip through Charlevoix, which nearly killed me, but it was, you know, never, it was an undertaking that I just felt quintessentially Quebecois, and I was, you know, grateful to be part of it. So there's that outdoor culture that you would find just, and it's just as strong as it is in BC, I think. Because it's French, the French are philosophical, and I find that in Beside, there's this existential quality, you know, there's that kind of, you know, I actually just recently interviewed David Saint-Jacques, who was a Quebec astronaut. He was the last Canadian to do a spacewalk. Would have imagined an astronaut to be a sort of a very technical kind of mind, but he was a real poet. You should try to get him on the show if you can. He's a dream to talk to. And he talks about the Earth hanging in space, you know, with this tiny cloak of atmosphere. And he's so eloquent about it. And I was just thinking about it because the publisher's note also is this kind of from space kind of view. This is our only planet and we're here. So I think that the magazine combines those two elements that blue marble, this gorgeous, gorgeous little terrarium in the reaches of space with that let's get outside and go tromping through the snow kind of mentality. You know, the two come together and it's quite a beautiful marriage. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that. So you mentioned that you wanted to write about the ocean, and you talked about that piece on shifting baselines, yeah, where you mentioned Daniel Pauly and so on. But have you written other articles about the ocean, and what was really interesting about that?
Yeah, well, this ties into our citizen science theme, because I got hooked up with the OceanWise for their last project and wrote about it for Beside, where we did some surreptitious genetic testing on some local fish. Yeah.
I remember reading about that.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, I did, did some fish and chip restaurants in the city. It's such a cool project. You take a piece and mail it in, and then they give you. And that, of course, the punchline is that most fish isn't what you think it is. I mean, cod's not a perfect example because cod is typically cod. It's not. I mean, you can. Other white fish can be flipped in, but generally, that's interesting because most restaurants have no idea where their cod comes from, and then beyond that, I mean, where consumers are being duped to an outlandish degree. I forget all the stats off the top of my head, but it is shocking the degree to which the things that we buy are mislabeled. And that's because the global supply chain is insane for fish. And just as a side note, because I was also writing, I wrote a couple stories about bluefin, and that's an interesting story because that became a delicacy. Sushi caught on. I mean, it's so recent. It's just like the last few decades. Sushi caught on in California in like the 70s, you know what I mean? And then it became huge in the 80s and into the 90s, and now of course it's really big. And bluefin went from being a garbage fish that nobody cared about, that they literally made into cat food or just buried if they caught it. They only wanted to see it for its size, they just caught it for fun. And then now, of course it's this prized fish that's been fished nearly to extinction, and they've been catching it in PEI, where I'm from, sport fishermen having a grand time catching it, except for now the bluefin swim up to the boats because they're starving, because the herring fishery's overfished, so they can put them on the line really easily now. Anyway, it's all sort of bleak, but what's interesting about that is that the global supply chain was really kicking in. I mean, flight also. I mean, airplanes are not that old, on the scale of things, So then they started at the same time that sushi became popular, they started catching bluefin and PEI and Cape Breton, flying it to Japan for processing, and then flying it to California or to Toronto to be eaten. And at the same time that they invented refrigerators, like it all just kind of happened, and then the whole ocean just went like, just those kinds of stories just they make me shiver. I just can't believe this world that we live in. So that ties in also to these other stories about there's so much obscurity layered in when you have fish being caught in one place and processed somewhere else and packaged somewhere else and then devoured somewhere else, all in the space of a couple days.
And do you remember any of these fish tests where people were thinking they were eating one thing? Did you find out what they were actually eating?
I don't have it in my head, but I know for sure that people are wildly overpaying when it always is in favor of somebody along the line to to change the label. So people are paying a lot of money for common fish. That's certainly true. Mm. But I wish I had the numbers. You'll have to look it up or something.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So in terms of the visual presentation of the Beside magazine, and of course it's published 2 times a year, but the rest is it's an online publication, right?
Yeah.
So how would you describe the visual presentation both on the web and in print form?
We won a National Magazine Award last year for our design and primarily for the photography that we feature. I'm a writer, always just been about text but now really much more involved in collaborations between writers and photographers. So we're always working with photographers. I think that we it makes for a lot of scrolling on Instagram and, you know, hunting out, you know, I'm constantly searching for new photographers. But there are, we just work with the best people. And so it's been, there's a lot of exciting people that we get to work with. Yeah. And it's, and I would make the distinction that we're not to speak ill of it, but we're different than, you know, like a National Geographic or something like that. It's not a wildlife. It's not a landscape publication. It's really it's our mission is bridging the gap between nature and culture. So we're always looking at the ways that people are either, you know, reclaiming and recovering traditional practice or finding ways to be on the land, you know. So it's that synthesis of sort of the old and new that we're always kind of hunting out, you know. So we just love to meet those people that are, you know, at the vanguard of this transformed relationship with the earth that we're all kind of pulling for, you know. So we're all just trying to, you know, find those brave souls who are a couple of steps ahead of most people, you know.
For sure. And obviously Montreal is a food city, a restaurant city, and of course, we're living in a time where they're having a real rough time mm-hmm. of it. But there is definitely, I think there has been, at least over the last 10 years or so, an attempt by many restaurants to look for an authentic Quebec cuisine, right? And, mm-hmm. and you know, I mean, my favorite restaurant is Joe Beef and Liverpool House. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, they published their two cookbooks, which are also stories that link, you mm-hmm. know, humans to nature and to tradition.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
And so how much of that is factored into what you're covering in the magazine? Or?
A lot. Yeah. We do food stories. Ariane Paré-Lagalle, if you've been to Jean Talon Market, you might recognize their stand, Guillaume Legal. He's been creating products from wild gathering and foraging, I think for 3 or 4 decades, and now they have all the, it's called Gourmet Sauvage.
Yeah, I know them. Yeah. I bought some of their products before.
Yeah, they're so cool. Yeah, so that's just an example. I mean, I think we were very interested in cuisine and the intersection of eating, and because that's actually really our primary contact with the natural world is what we put on our plates, you know. So we never miss that topic when we put an issue together. Yeah.
Nice. Well, we're basically out of time, but I guess if people are interested in finding out about the magazine, where would they go on the web, or do you know what it costs to subscribe?
And... Yeah, for sure. So you can find us online. It's pretty easy URL to remember. It's just beside.media. So it's the word beside.media. So it's pretty simple to look up. It costs $35 per year. So it's pretty cheap. That's for two copies. People tell me all the time that they subscribe. I think people really enjoy having this around, and it's a big thick book, so you know, you can when you get it, you can spend a good few weeks pouring through it.
nice. Well, thanks so much for joining me today. Mark,
thanks for great. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks.
And that was my interview with Mark Mann, who's the assistant editor-in-chief of Beside Magazine. Beside Magazine is published in print form twice a year. The current edition is the 9th edition, and it's about how do we embrace or how do we embody our Nordicity. And it's really a magazine dedicated to bridging the gap between humans and nature. And of course, they have a whole online feature as well. And the magazine, when it comes out in print, is printed on Rolyn Enviro paper, which is 100% post-consumer paper. So that's great. So if you like listening to this show, I'm sure you'll like reading this magazine. So check it out, Beside Magazine, which is published by Beside Media. And if you're interested in getting a subscription, it's only $35. And you can go and look for that at besidemagazine.com. Well, that's all the time we have in the show. Thanks for listening. My name is Ryan Young. You can follow us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/EcoLibrium CKUT Montreal. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young, and I'm on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. Thanks for listening. We're going to leave you with some Christmas jazz music, and this is Duke Pearson with the tune Sleigh Ride. Enjoy.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding at ckut.ca if you have any questions.
The COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
In the fight against COVID-19, we must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
My name is Debi, storyteller, dub poet, partly raised in Montreal, Montreal, Montreal.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
In the fight against COVID-19, we must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip, and self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Everyone's health is in our hands, now more than ever. The COVID Alert app on my phone notifies me if I've been in contact with someone who recently tested and declared positive. Protecting my health and that of my loved ones is at my fingertips. I can simply download the COVID Alert app, an app that respects my privacy.